This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam, and joining me is Will. And we are continuing our series in the life of Abraham, and we're coming to Genesis chapter 24 today. And this is going to be a chapter that's entirely devoted to finding a bride for Isaac. Mm-hmm. Because if salvation is going to come through the line of Isaac, what do you need?
We need more kids.
We need kids. We need a family. We need a wife. So now we're getting to this point where there's going to be a marriage. And one of the things that I want everybody to recognize when we go, and we're going to kind of blow the ending, but I want you to pay attention to this, is the Abrahamic pattern of life is so very clearly pointing you to the story of redemption and how it's laid out. But pay attention to it, because like we just came through Genesis 22 a couple of weeks ago, or last week. And what was that all about? It was about God coming to Abraham and asking the father to sacrifice his son, and all the language, right, was pointing you to Jesus. But there, you know, he spared, he wasn't going to die, but it was very clearly prophetic of Jesus. But now let's think through the entire Abraham story in light of that. We get God who comes and promises Abraham a son, right? So from the beginning of his story, it's like, you're going to have a son, right? And it's going to bless the nations. But there's this long wait, and then the son is born. Think of this as the entire story of redemption, right? The son is promised. Well, when does that happen? That happens way long ago. And then there's this long wait of thousands of years before Jesus is born, and then the son is sacrificed, right? And sacrificed, right, with Isaac.
Air quotes for audio listeners.
That's right. But then what happens after the son is resurrected from the dead? He doesn't stay dead. The decree of death doesn't work. He's risen from the dead. He ascends into heaven. And now what does he do? Like in the book of Acts in the New Testament, what's the next mission? It's like Jesus says, okay, I've done my part. Now I'm commissioning you to do what? To go to the ends of the earth. To do what?
Make disciples.
To make disciples, which are going to be called the bride of Christ. The church becomes the bride. So in a sense, this risen one is sending, commissioning his followers to go forward, to go to the ends of the earth, to find a bride for the son. And what is that bride going to be asked to do? To leave everything.
Yeah.
And to go and to enter into a marital covenant of faith with God the Son. And so the whole story that's being laid out here, and we're going to see that in Genesis 24, but the whole story of Abraham is kind of laying out a pattern of what ultimately happens with God the Father and his son, Jesus. And we play a role in that, yeah, in this story, cool. Yeah. Which is pretty cool. So let's jump in to Isaac's story, and starting in chapter 24, verse 1, his mother has just died, so now it's Abraham and Isaac. Isaac's 40 years old by this point, and Abraham still hasn't gotten a wife for him, which is like, what are you doing? Like, why are you waiting
stuff,
so long?
Okay?
He's got stuff to do. But Abraham's old, well-advanced in years. It's saying, you know, he's coming to the twilight of his
life.
He's old, the Bible says.
He's done.
Next chapter, he's going to die. And the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Like, this guy is now tremendously wealthy. He's got faith. He believes in God. Everything around him is just blessed. And so Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh, that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell, but you will go to my country and to my kindred and take a wife for my son Isaac." So there's a lot already that we find in just those couple of verses.
Yeah, where is he putting his hand?
So this is one of the things that when you look at it, it says that he takes the servant. By the way, who's the servant?
Eliezer.
So if you remember in Genesis 15, when that chapter begins, what is Abraham? He's debating with God because God said, you're going to have a son. And Eliezer's like, you still given me no son. I have no one to leave any of my stuff to. I'm going to leave it all to Eliezer of Damascus, who's his chief servant. And God comes and says, you're not giving it to Eliezer. I'm going to provide you a son. Well, now you have this servant who stood to inherit everything from Abraham. God now provides Isaac, the son, and now Eliezer has to go find a bride for him. So it's, you're thinking, like, he's working against his own interests, right? Because if Isaac's not in the picture, who gets all the money?
Eliezer.
And so this guy's faithful. He's a servant to Abraham, even at his own expense. He's like, all right, yep, I'm in. I'm gonna take this mission. But Abraham has this really bizarre thing that when you read the commentaries, it's like, do we even talk about this? Because it's so weird. But in verse 2, it says he takes the servant who had charge over everything, and he says, put your hand under my thigh. Well, the word for thigh there can mean thigh. It can mean
totally just a thigh.
Upper thigh, yeah. But a lot of times in Scripture, and almost every commentary that you read on this, and every ancient historical commentary or Christian theologian, almost all of them agree that this is talking about genitals. So now it just got a lot more awkward, right?
It did, yeah.
So the Hebrew word can apply to both. And before you get mad at me, let me just walk through the list of famous people. Jerome, who wrote the Bible, translated the Bible into Latin.
He would know.
The Latin Vulgate says that. St. Augustine says that. Martin Luther, father of the Reformation, said that. John Calvin, kind of big dog in the Reformed faith, said that. John Gill, Matthew Henry, Adam Clark, Charles Spurgeon, Origen, John Wesley, Clement of Alexandria. That list can go and go and go and go. But the big dogs of the faith have all agreed that's what's going on here. So Abraham is looking at his servant saying, I'm about to send you on one of the most important missions, finding a bride for my son that's going to have an influence over the line of salvation. Like, this is a big deal. Now, I want to enter into a covenant with you. I want you to take your hand and put it under my genitals. If you're like, we hear that and we're like, weird. What in the world? And probably, I imagine the servant even back then was like, oh man, you know, like, this
doesn't seem to happen
awkward.
A lot.
What's that?
It doesn't seem to happen a lot.
No. It does happen, and it'll happen in Genesis 47. Where, you know, you have them swearing, like, don't bury, leave my bones in Egypt.
But it's real serious situations where this comes
into play.
So there's a reason for this.
So if you're imagining what's going on here, why in the world would this be? Because it's not perverse. Like,
it's not.
Get that out of your mind. Like, that's not where this is going. But it's like saying, hey, I'm trusting you with something that is, like, life and death here. This is so important.
Yeah.
And so as a demonstration of how much I trust you to carry this out, I'm going to allow you to put your hand in a region where I have to trust you, right? But it's not just that. It's I want you to make an oath, like we put our hand on the Bible. Like, this would be like, I want your hand to be near the very source of life and death for me. This is that serious. So I trust you. I'm making myself vulnerable to you, but also you have the power of life and death and how you deal with this covenant that you're about to enter. And oh, by the way, what was the sign of the covenant given to Abraham that set God's people apart? It was the sign of
circumcision,
which is in that region, right?
Yep.
So everything is revolving around that covenant. It's a real awkward one where it's like, what? Like, do I even want to continue with this episode? But it's like, hey, this is real serious.
And that practice stopped, which is okay, too.
Yeah.
Like, don't need to do this today.
Yeah, if my boss comes to me and asks me to do that, I'm calling HR.
Leave this in Scripture. Just shake hands.
Yeah, that's right. Shake hands, that's good enough. But that I may make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, that you won't take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites. Why not?
Because they're not a part of God's people.
They are. And they're not just not part of God's people, because the people way, way back where he's going to send them aren't necessarily a part of the covenant people. It's saying that these people among the Canaanites are so wicked. Like, the way that they worship their gods is so repulsive. The way that they sacrifice their children, we talked about last episode, is so atrocious. I do not want my son marrying into that line. I want you to go back to the land where I come from to find a bride. Do not take one from among the Canaanites. And by the way, in Genesis 9, what does God say when Ham shames Noah? Cursed be
Canaan,
right? So there's going to be redeemed Canaanites in heaven. We know that. There's going to be redeemed Canaanites in the Scriptures. God's mercy is available to them. But as a people, as a culture, they are so absolutely repulsive that God's like, I do not want my son to take a wife from among them. In the New Testament, by the way, that's not abnormal. In the New Testament, we're told that you should not be unequally yoked. Have you ever heard that expression before? Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
I mean, non-Christians shouldn't marry Christians.
Yeah, that's right. Like, if you're going to be yoked, think of two oxen pulling something.
We got to believe the same things.
You got to go in the same direction. If you have those oxen that believe, one believes in Jesus and one believes in Hinduism or something, like, they're going to be pulling in the opposite direction. Nobody's going to enjoy that. Like, you need to be covenantally pulling mm-hmm. in the same direction. That's what Abraham at least wants. He's like, I know where they come from. I know what they believe. They're going to have heard of our God because I left there with my story. They're going to at least have an open door to it. So go to my country. And the servant said to him, but perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came? And Abraham is very clear here. He says, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me and swore to me, to your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son there. So what's going on here?
He's real serious about not taking Isaac back there.
Isaac cannot go back there. Why do you think that is? Why do you think Abraham's like, no, he can't go. I don't want him to be a part of the selection process. I don't want him to go there. Because it doesn't tell us.
No, yeah, there's not a clear answer.
A theoretical. I've got some ideas.
Okay, what's your theoretical?
So I used to think that Abraham was afraid that if Isaac went back there, that he would be like, oh man, this is really nice. Like,
pull a lot on him.
Why in the, because remember when Abraham was complaining, like, God led me astray, he made me wander. Like, clearly in Abraham's flesh, he's like, that place was pretty nice, and now I'm stuck down here with all this stuff going on. Like, I used to think that Isaac was like, if he goes, Abraham was thinking, if Isaac goes there, he may not come back, and God's promise is for him to take possession, for the descendants to take possession of this land. I don't want them going back to that land. That's what I used to think. Now I think what Abraham wants to see, he wants Isaac to have a bride who's got a faith like Abraham.
And Sarah's.
And Sarah's, right? So think about it this way. I want her to be able to pledge to pick up and leave her father's household, to leave everything that she knows from the land that I left, and come sight unseen mm-hmm. to my son, whom she's never met, to a land that she's never lived in or seen before, all on faith. Mm-hmm. And if she can risk that journey and walk away from everything, then she's got the kind of faith that I have. But if Isaac has to go there and Isaac has to win her and she has to see and, you know, measure up and be like, oh yeah, this is good. Yeah, I'm in.
Yeah, this is good for me.
That's not the kind of faith that Abraham is accustomed to. He wants to see who will come. Who will come with that kind of faith? What do you think of that?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So anyway, that's what I think.
So we know Abraham's not afraid of death now.
Yeah.
You know, he has shown us that he does trust Isaac's life with God. So he's not afraid, like, oh, if Isaac goes, maybe he'll die, maybe he'll get scared, whatever it is.
And I also love this as well. He's like, God's going to send an angel to, like, guide you. Abraham is absolutely 100% convinced that the Lord is in this plan more than he is. And so it's like, God's not going to fail. He's going to guide you by an angel, which, by the way, you never see the angel show up that's like, hey, Eliezer, let's go this way. Like, but you assume that the sovereignty of God is involved in this, that he's orchestrating everything, which you'll see. And so Abraham has 100% faith. Like, I'm too old to go. I don't want Isaac to go. I'm putting all my trust in you, it sounds like. But where does Abraham genuinely trust? God's going to show you. God's got this. So I'm going to ask you to do it, but it's going to be an angel. It's going to be the hand of the Lord that leads you. And it says, but if the woman's not willing to follow you, you're free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there. So if you don't find a woman, no, this is not your problem. Then we just don't get a wife from there, but you're free of this oath. So what are you hearing that? Now it's like we talked about. Now the father is commissioning the servant to go to the distant land to find a bride for the son of promise. Hmm. What's the metaphor there?
Jesus.
Yeah. It's Jesus. It's us. Like, this is kind of our story. Like, God is laying this out to where there's particular characters involved. You have Abraham. Who would Abraham be in the metaphor?
God the Father.
God the Father. Isaac, who's Isaac in the metaphor?
Jesus the Son.
Who's Rebecca?
Us, the bride, the church.
Yeah, the bride that needs to be discovered to be brought back into a covenantal relationship with the Son. Well, who's Eliezer?
Us too.
We're the evangelists.
After coming to faith.
Yeah, I'm taking the treasure and the allure of what the Father and the Son have to offer you, and I'm asking you to leave your former life, to make a leap of faith, to come with me to a son that you've never met before, you've never laid eyes on, that you're going to trust your life to. And that's, I mean, this whole thing is kind of the pattern of the gospel again, right? And so the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, awkward moment.
Sealed the deal.
That's right, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant, like right on obedience, and you're going to find like this servant
he's good.
Is all about Abraham's business. He's all about doing his master's business.
Mission is all what he's about.
Yeah, so like you remember all the chapters where everybody's constantly stumbling and bumbling and making a mess of things? Like, all of a sudden, we've hit our stride. Abraham's got it. He's obedient. He believes in the resurrection. You're going to see the servant is awesome. You see Rebecca is awesome. You see Isaac's awesome. And it's like there's really no bad news. I mean, apart from maybe Laban being greedy. Like, it's everything is good. It's all doing what it's supposed to. And it says, then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed. So now we're talking about a journey, let's say from Hebron, where Abraham is, to go all the way to the city of Nahor and the region of Haran. We're talking about 450 miles straight line. Hmm. But if you were to follow like the place where they would have gone,
the wells
and everything else, probably 550 miles.
Wow.
So this is on a camel. Yeah. So we're talking about, this is going to be a month, two, 3 months. Like it's going to take you a while to accomplish this journey with a caravan and everything else. And so Abraham sends him, he goes, and Isaac is just sitting there wondering, like, I wonder what she's going to be like. Is he going to find someone? Like, there's this anticipation. Is the bride going to come? Verse 10, then the servant took 10 of his master's camels and departed, taking all sorts of choice gifts from his master. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. This is where Abraham came from. In fact, Nahor's his brother's name. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when women go out to draw water. So this was considered in the ancient world, this was the time, a role that was designed for women, that they would go out carrying all the buckets. Still to this day in a lot of third world countries, you see women that have to travel long distances to go get water from the well. And why in the world in those cultures it's always reserved for the women? I don't know.
Yeah, the woman at the well with Jesus.
But that's, you find it again and again. Like, the well is like the hot spot for dating in the ancient
Heck
world.
Yeah.
So it just is. So if you look here.
It's a literal watering hole, you know?
That's right. Ah. Uh-huh. But you have Isaac's bride, Rebecca, found at a well. Where does Jacob find Rachel?
At a well.
At a well. Where does Moses find Zipporah?
At a well.
At a well. And then when you come to Jesus, we'll get into this later, but you find this Samaritan woman, adulterous woman,
at a well.
Ruth, by the way, with Boaz, like he offers her a drink, which is presumptive from
it's
a well.
Stretch.
Like it is not.
I'm not going.
It's totally,
I want wells.
It's a spring. Same thing. Anyway, so he gets there and he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at the time of evening, the time when women go to draw water. And he said, oh Lord, he's praying, right? God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show steadfast love to my master Abraham. You just finished this journey of, you know, hundreds of miles through desert conditions with camels and everything else. Now you're here. It's the moment of truth. Yeah. Like, please make this fruitful, not a wasted fool's errand. I'm standing by the spring of water and the daughters of men of the city are coming out to draw water. And then he lays down this challenge to God. Verse 14, let the young woman to whom I say, please let down your jar that I may drink. And who shall then say, drink and I will water your camels. Let her be the one whom you've appointed for your servant Isaac. By this I shall know that you have shown steadfast love to my master. So all these women are coming, right, to the well. And everyone that comes, he's got a plan. He's going to say, oh, can I have a drink? And it's the one, if she responds, oh, sure, here's a drink, And can I also take care of all of your camels for
10 of them.
10 of them. Which, do you know how much water a camel would require after coming through a desert journey, like to refill?
No idea, to be honest.
At least 20 gallons per camel. So we're talking about a well, which you've seen these ancient wells. You've seen your wife, like, pulling up the thing from the... So now you've got to imagine her saying, oh, 200 gallons? Absolutely, I'm on it.
And you don't have a bunch of, like, you have one bucket.
Yeah.
Like, you don't just got, like, you don't just do it 20 times and then do it. It's like, no, you got to do it, let him drink, come back. So it's a wild approach.
So why would this be the test?
It's a generosity test. It's a personality test. It kind of shows what this woman will be without really saying any words or interviewing anything.
Yeah. Is she humble? Does she have a servant's heart? Does she look at the foreigner and the stranger that's come that is totally at the mercy of the people who live there? Is she the person who's like, let me show you hospitality. Let me take care of you. Does she have a nurturing heart? Is she humble? Like, it's a weird sign, but it's certainly going to reveal a lot of character. Like, anybody who would do this is a good-hearted, compassionate person.
And, like, bold of Eleazar to be like, God, I got a really, really specific thing that I need you to make happen.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
He's
really trusting that his master said an angel's going to go with you.
That's true. All right, God, show off.
You said this is going to happen, so here we go.
Truth. So verse 15, it says, before he had finished speaking. So he hasn't even, like, there's not, like, a flurry of them. The first one, before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, came. So this is family, right? And he doesn't know this yet, but this is, so Isaac is the son of Abraham. This is going to get confusing.
Yeah, this is a tree I don't
want to do. So Abraham has a brother, Nahor, who had a son, Bethuel, and a wife, Milcah, who have a daughter. So it's cousin once removed. So it's an extra generation for Rebekah, because remember, Isaac is born really late to Abram.
That's true.
And so you've got an extra generation thrown in there, but they're cousins. So just deal with it. Anyway, this young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came back up. And the servant ran to meet her and said, please give me a little water to drink from your jar. And what does she say? God showing off. She said, drink, my Lord. And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. And when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I'll draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. Not like, you know, when you're in college and you need gas and you put like 3 gallons in because you're bankrupt. This is like, I'm filling you up and I'm going all the way until I can't give them anymore. So they're going to be completely filled. It's not just let me give them water. It's like, I want them filled to the brim. And it's like, holy cow. All right, verse 19. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will water for your camels also until they have finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. And the man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. So now, what do we know about Rebekah? Like, we know that she's got an incredible heart. Like, super compassionate, humble, generous. We know that she's extremely beautiful, we're told here. What else? What else can we pull out of this? She's a virgin. She cares for her purity. Like, so if you're Eliezer, you're like...
Fingers crossed right now.
Yeah, like, I really hope this works out, because this woman is absolutely amazing in every respect. And so let's pause here. We're going to pick back up here in a moment. But Jesus will meet a woman at a well. And like we said... Who do you find at a well?
Women.
A wife, right? This is Isaac's wife, Jacob's wife, Moses' wife, Boaz's wife. No, just get over it.
It's not at a well.
But then Jesus comes, and who does he meet at a well?
The Samaritan woman.
So immediately, like, of course, he's not marrying her. That's not what this is about. But what's your mind? If you know your Old Testament, who do you meet at a well?
Brides.
You meet brides, except Jesus, does he get the beautiful woman? Does he get the woman who's the virgin? Does he get the woman who's super generous? Does he get the woman who's like, oh, can I give you water? Mm-hmm. Like, no, he goes and sits down. She never offers him water. He's like, if you knew who I was, you would ask me for water. But she doesn't. She's an adulteress. She's been married 5 times. The guy she's living with now is not her own. This is John 4. everything about her is the opposite of Rebecca, right? Like, no doubt Eliezer's looking at Rebecca being like, this is the perfect bride. This is the one. Oh, I hope she says yes. Jesus, when he gives his comparison of who he's going to meet at a well, who is it? The half-breed, a Samaritan, half-Jew, half-Assyrian, going back, like, oh, shameful pedigree. They're hated in the ancient world. She's morally shameful. She's rejected in her own town. She's avoiding people by going to the well at midday. Everything about her is the anti-Rebecca. And what do you learn from that?
That's who Jesus is after.
That's who Jesus is after. Jesus doesn't get the virginal, beautiful bride. It's not who he's after. But what does he say to her? Like, you're exactly who the Father's looking for.
What?
And I'm here for you.
And then she becomes a servant who goes out and tells people.
That's right. That's right. Kind of, and she is counted among the bride of Christ. And so, but that's just a beautiful thing. Like, that's not an accidental comparison, by the way. And by the way, it's Jacob's well where he meets her, which it's meant to draw your, hey, this is where Jacob found his bride. Like, and he meets her, you know, this Gentile Jew, all these things that are reflective of who we are. We're the unfaithful one. And Jesus is like, nope. I'm looking for
that's
you.
The one, yeah.
I'm looking for you.
It's amazing.
So verse 22, it says, when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel, so that's just super generous, and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels. So now imagine she's just filled up all the camels and she's just doing this out of the kindness of her heart. And all of a sudden he's decking her out in jewelry. And he said, please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night? And she says, I'm the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. And she added, we have plenty of straw and fodder and room for you to spend the night. And so now he's like, this is family. Like, yeah, we have an inn. This is a connection. The man bowed his head and worshiped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master. Notice what he's saying. Faithfulness toward my master. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing his bidding. But God's faithfulness is toward his master. As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman. Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about all these things. Well, Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban. And Laban ran out toward the man. What do we know about Laban later on? He's a schemer.
Yeah.
Like, Jacob is going to be a schemer. Isaac and Rebecca's kid's going to be a mess. And Laban
Raven's
is quite
go.
The schemer, super greedy dude. He runs out to meet him at the spring, and as soon as he, notice what it says, verse 30, as soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, what's he after? Is he thinking, I want a good husband for my...
I need some cash.
No. He's like...
Give him some gold.
Look at that. This guy's got money. All right. And he heard the words of Rebecca, his sister, saying, thus this man spoke to me. And so he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring, and he said, come in, oh, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside? For I've prepared the house and a place for the camels. And so the man came into the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels. And there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, I will not eat. This is where you find out how he is all about his master's business. I will not eat until I have said what I have to say. And so Laban's like, okay, well, speak on. Right? So everything that's going on here, God ordained.
Yeah, even getting to town, he didn't take a break.
Yeah.
He got right after. It's not like I'll check into a hotel and I'll figure this out later, get a good night rest because I've just walked here or been ridden a camel.
Yeah.
Have you ever ridden a camel? It's not comfy. For very long.
Not comfy
so
at
it
all.
It is all about the mission, which is cool.
And he won't take a break. Like, it's not like, oh, finally, you know, I'm just going to sit here and relax for a moment. Oh, stretch out. Yeah. And it's like, nope, I'm not even going to have a morsel before I say what my master's business is. And by the way, Abraham's not going to know this. So it's all in this conscience. It's just pure loyalty to Abraham.
That is true. I never thought about that.
It's love. Like, he could have been like, oh, they're not going to know anything.
Well, Abraham's not checking in on him.
Yeah. There's not like life 360.
When you get there. Yeah.
So he said, I'm Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master. And you just see how much he reveres Abraham. And he has become great. He has given him, God has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. What is he saying? You want to marry into this line.
Yeah, he's rich.
And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he's given all that he has. My master's made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites. That's why I traveled all the way up here. And I can't take the Canaanites in whose land I dwell, but I should go to my father's house, to his father's house, to his clan, to take a wife for his son. And I said to my master, perhaps the woman will not follow me. But he said to me, the Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel with you and prosper your way. You'll take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. And if they will not give her to you, you'll be free from the oath. So he's like rehearsing all this. I came today to the spring, and guess what? The Lord, the God of my master Abraham, I said to him, if now you are prospering the way that I go, behold, I'm standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes out to draw water, to whom I shall say, please give me a little water from your jar to drink, and who will say to me, drink, and I'll draw water for your camels also. Let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son. So now he's laying it out. He's not only being like, hey, look at all the money. This is just a foretaste of what she's in for if she comes back home with me. Oh, by the way, it was the angel that led me here to you. Abraham said that I was supposed to go to my... Look, and it landed right exactly where we are. Everything that's going on, all the ways that God has blessed my master is now could be Rebecca's story as well. It's like he's laying out all the incentives of God's faithfulness, how God's anointing is on this home. And says, before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, she came out with a water jar on her shoulder, and she went down to the spring and drew water. And I said to her, please let me drink. And she quickly let down her jar from her shoulder and said, drink. I will give your camels drink also. And so I drank. She gave the camels drink also. And then I asked her, whose daughter are you? It's basically like we're going through this whole chapter, but it's like, dude, like we know already.
He's good at what he does.
That's true. Then I asked her, whose daughter are you? And she said, the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him. So I put a ring on her nose, which, by the way, nose ring. How do you feel about that? I
feel great about it.
You like nose rings?
No. Not you on don't? Me. Would you get one?
No, definitely not on me.
Would you do the one that's on the inside?
No. Like the bull one that you should? And I got to get over it because here we find like it seems to be
status thing
approved to like... I'm not crazy about nose rings, but good on him. Like they appreciated it back then. So who am I? It's all cultural stuff. I don't think there's anything wrong with it anyway. And put bracelets on her arms. Then I bowed my head and worshiped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master, Abraham, who led me the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. So he's rehearsing all this for them. Now then, if you're going to show steadfast love and faithfulness to my master, tell me. And if not, tell me that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. He's like, look, if you're not going to do this, like I'm out. Like, yeah. I don't even need to stay here. I'm all about my master's business. Are you in or are you out? All right. So if you're looking at Eliezer's case to them and you're comparing it to the evangelism of trying to compel or invite the bride to come to Jesus, how would this translate?
Well, I think the one is... not answering that question, but how the servant handles what the master's given him. Does that make sense?
Okay. Because
Eliezer has been given this vast fortune.
Yeah, he could have gone anywhere.
He could have done whatever he wanted. And he probably had to manage it along the way. I'm not stopping, but I had to eat, those kinds of things. So for him even to show up on the scene with everything and to protect everything, if you're traveling 10 camels and you're Eliezer, I mean, you have to protect the master's stuff too. So there's one part where it's like, oh, that's pretty cool. And the other part is he does. It's a good case to take him up on a yes here.
That's right.
It's a very good case to be like, he laid it very well to say like, no, this is a beautiful thing that would be great for your daughter.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm getting at. Like if we take the metaphor that this is, it is the story of Isaac and it's the story of Rebecca. Course.
They're real people.
But I do believe that there's a metaphor at play here that God is ordaining. And it's like, okay, so if I'm the Eliezer and I'm going out to the far places to find people that don't yet have a relationship with the son, but I'm inviting them into it and asking them to leave everything they know in order to pledge their lives to the son that they've never met. What would be my case? Like if I'm Eliezer coming into the home of an unbeliever saying you should really give your life to Jesus, what would the sales pitch look like? And you look at what Eliezer has to say and it's like, he goes on and he's like, man, you should see the faithfulness that God has shown to Abraham. And it makes you wonder, like, how much of that does he share? You know, how much of God's faithfulness to Abraham? And, you know, he does say he's blessed them abundantly with material possessions. And here it's all evident on display. Like,
he does kind of hold back the son of promise thing, though. So there is something to where, like, there is a bit of faith on her part.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. It does make you wonder, like, what's not recorded? Because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm sure there's other things that are happening that are not all written out here. Like, does that come up? Does that excite her? I don't know. That's a good point.
But he does look ready for this, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah. Oh, he's rehearsed this.
Yeah, he's waiting for the question. He's all about the mission, as we've been saying, but he does have his talk prepared.
Yeah. So it's like if you get an opportunity to talk to somebody and you're like, hey, I want you to leave everything you've ever known and give your life to the Son of the Father.
Yeah.
What would your case be? Like, I think all of us should have something that's ready to go. And looking at this, it's not, you know, it's like, look at his faithfulness to so many others. Look what he's done for me. Look what he offers to you. Look at the treasure that you have in store for you forever. Look at, I mean, it's like he comes in with this rehearsed pitch, and he's not, by the way, Abram's like, if they reject you, you're free.
Yeah.
Like, that's not on you. Mm-hmm. But go make the offer, right?
And he made the supernatural a huge part of that offer, mm-hmm. which I think is fascinating. Yeah, in our world today, like, he didn't lead with, like, hey, mm-hmm. this is, I mean, cool. Here's the physical things, here's what you're good at. But, like, look at what God has done just to make this happen. It's like, in our world that's so materialistic, man, and I think we are seeing more of this in our culture and around the world, like, getting back to the supernatural elements of mm-hmm. faith, not, you know, not the weird stuff or whatever, or you know, name it and claim it stuff, or, you know, whatever that kind of stuff is. But, like, no, God is a supernatural God who can do things like this.
Yeah.
That he ordained something so particular to find a bride. What else could he do?
Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like, you would go through your story and be like, look at how he's ordained all of my story. I can go back through the last 46 years, you know, and just see how God has put these little forks in the road that have put me exactly where I'm supposed to be, you know, with blessings beyond measure. Like, I wouldn't trade anything in my story. Or change anything, because I see God's hand of sovereignty over all of it.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, when we get those opportunities to invite somebody into that eternal marital contract with God, you know, we should be ready to say, like, this is what he offers you. You know, this is what he can spare you from. This is his faithfulness that he's shown to me and so many others. Like, and Eliezer's like, let's go, I got this. Boom. I mean, you can almost tell he's rehearsed it.
And it's like what Dostoevsky said, beauty will save the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good picture of that. Like, lead with a beautiful picture of the gospel.
Yeah.
We're all desiring that.
Yeah, everybody. We have a homing beacon or something in our heart that's drawn to the story. All the greatest stories mirror the gospel. So how do we present that to the person who is in a situation that ultimately ends in the grave, and introduce them to the one that can overcome it and give purpose to life. So verse 50, Laban and Bethuel answer and say, verse 50, then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing has come from the Lord. Like, after hearing all that, they're like, this is very obviously, clearly he's involved in this. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah's before you, take her and go. Let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord had spoken. Now here, this is something that's definitely uncomfortable for modern ears. Like, two guys being like, here, take her, she's yours. You know, the idea of arranged marriages even at all is something that's bothersome. But this is something that might not be a popular thing to say. But the gospel's an arranged marriage. Hmm. You know that, right?
I do, yeah.
Where the father has done what? He's paid a bride price, which is his son on a cross. And by the way, Ephesians, what does it say? He chose us in him before the foundations of the world. You have been chosen to be part of the bride of Christ. That has been arranged. He has changed your heart. The Spirit has called you to him. And that's a weird thing, but the gospel is the story of an arranged marriage.
And Sam, you have one daughter, so send in applications, everybody. If you have.
Yeah.
But we can arrange something.
Let me ask you this question. As a dad who loves your kids very much, is there any part of you that would be like, I would like to have a hand in making sure don't marry the wrong person? Yeah.
Even in my life, I was very much like to my parents, like, do you think this is right? Like, I was 23 when I got married, and people were like, it's too young. It's like,
yeah. Yeah. Back then, it would have been like, you're anxious.
Hey, he's 40 here. So
that's true. That's true. So here's a little factoid, like brief. Here we go. We're off on a tangent now. Did you know that the majority of marriages in our world today are arranged marriages still?
Yeah, because some of the major countries with population densities.
So enormous numbers out of Africa. India, obviously, is the most populous country. 55% of all new marriages are arranged. And so that, when I heard that, I was like, no way, whoa, because I'm Western eyes, that's weird. But here's what really shocked me is that when they do surveys in the all over the world, what they find is in cultures where there are arranged marriages, they prefer it at higher rates than in the West. We prefer it the other way. So a 2013 survey conducted in India found that 82% of young women ages 18 to 35 prefer arranged marriages over self-selected marriages. Now, here's another thing. It boasts the lowest divorce rates in nations where it's prevalent.
Are they allowed to get divorced?
Not really.
Okay.
I didn't want to hit that step. But here's less than 1% of Indians who've ever been married have experienced a divorce. But here it is. In the United States, where virtually all marriages are self-selected, the number leaps to 34% of marriages. But even in marriages where they have the option, so in a culture where it's like you could have an arranged marriage versus self-selected, they surveyed 357 married couples living in America and found that those that were living in an arranged marriage experienced, quote, significantly greater marital satisfaction than those living in self-selected marriages, which is interesting, where it becomes more about oath and covenant than emotion and what did you do for me lately? Like, mm-hmm. It's a different perspective. I'm not making a case for arranged marriages, I promise.
Yes, he is.
But what I am saying is that when you understand that marriage is a covenant, that it's like I'm promising you and I'm not going to walk away from you no matter what, it makes the marriage more
beautiful. Yeah, it's not self-selected love, like, oh, I have love today. Yeah. I don't have love tomorrow.
How do you measure up today? Yeah, is this a good marriage? Because are you making me happy at this moment? Like, that kind of idea of marriage is gross. It's so far from what marriage is supposed to be. Where arranged marriage, it's like, we didn't choose each other.
Your opinion doesn't matter.
But we got to get through this together, so let's work with each other, love each other, covenant with one another. And they end up, by the way, having a deeper bond of love emotionally in the long run than self-selected marriages. It's weird. I didn't expect to find that. Sorry. Now,
back on track.
Back on track. So they're like, yeah, here she is. And when Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the earth before the Lord. And the servant brought out jewelry of silver and of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. So she's decked out all of a sudden. And he also gave to her brother and to her mother costly ornaments. And all the men that were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night there. And they arose in the morning, and he said, send me away to my master. Like, basically, thanks so much for your hospitality. I don't have time to rest. We got to get back to Isaac. But her brother and her mother said, oh, well, let the young woman remain with us for a while, at least 10 days, and after that she may go. What are they doing?
They just want to get the cash cow for a little bit longer.
Yeah, like, oh, now that we know that he's got this and that he's given it to us, like,
we haven't seen camel number 10.
Yeah, that's right. What's behind door number 3? Like, we want even more. But he said to them, like, this is a good deal for Eliezer. Like, stay here. I get to relax. I get to enjoy. Like, y'all are going to treat me like a king because I am the cash cow. But he's like, nope, this isn't about what I want. Not about what I want. Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. And they said, let's call the young woman and ask her. So they called Rebekah and said to her, now this is the moment, right? Will you go with this man? And if you're her, it's like your whole life's about to change, and you're leaving right after you say whatever your answer is, or you're staying. Mm-hmm. Everything's in this decision. Your life radically changes based on how you respond to this invitation. Sound familiar? And what does she say? I will go.
Yes.
That's always the response of the person of faith. That's Abraham. Hey, I want you to leave everything I'll go. Ruth, where you go, I'll go. Like, I will go. I will leave it all behind to grab hold of this new covenant, this new promise. I'm all in. And Rebecca, she's so amazing. I will go. So they sent away Rebecca, their sister, and her nurse, and Abram's servant and his men, and they blessed Rebecca and said to her, our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s. Like, we want you to have so many kids. We're praying that you become great nations. Like, we want you to prosper, and may your offspring possess the gate. Remember, the gate is the government center of those who hate him. May he control all of his enemies. And then Rebecca and her young women arose and rode on the camels and followed the man. And thus the servant took Rebecca and went his way. Now Isaac, so now we camera shifts, verse 62, we're coming toward a landing. Now Isaac had returned from Beer Lahai Roy. What is that? Does that sound familiar? Remember that place?
Yeah, I do.
That's where Hagar, God comes to rescue Hagar. So
God who sees.
The God who sees. Why in the world did Isaac go down there? It's a holy place where God sees and hears. What do you think he's doing down there?
Praying for this.
Praying. He's praying for his bride. It's just really cool. This is Isaac has a heart of prayer. You see that. So he's returning from there and he's dwelling in the Negev in the desert. There's nothing there. There's no distractions. There's nothing to do. It's barren. And what's he doing? He went outside to meditate in the field. What is he doing there? He's praying.
Right.
He's thinking, God, what are you doing? What are you doing? What is she coming? Lord, bless her. Make this a good bride. Make this a good family. And he's praying in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold, there were camels coming.
And that's interesting because, like, he didn't know when they were going to return. Mm-hmm. So this was just his normal status for quite a long time. It wasn't like 72 hours. It was like...
Now this, we don't know, months. Like, how long is it going to be before he comes back? Has he been killed? Has he been taken? I mean, that would have... That was a danger in the ancient world. Like, and he's out there doing what? I'm going from the place of prayer. Okay, now that he should be coming back any day, I'm going to go and I'm going to sit out here in the Negev. And I'm just going to be looking. Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? You know that that's the heart of Christ even now, by the way? You know, when he says that he won't drink from the cup with them until we get to share it in paradise. Like, there's some sense in which Christ is like, the good stuff, I'm waiting. I'm waiting until they're with me. That's the heart of somebody who loves his bride. Like, I'm going to enjoy that when she's with me.
Yeah, intercede on our behalf.
Yeah, and that's the heart of Christ, and that's the heart of Isaac here, like just looking and waiting and looking and waiting, and man, when is she coming? When is she coming? And he lifted up his eyes, and behold, there were camels coming, and Rebecca lifted up her eyes.
Ooh.
And when she, this is the movie, romance. This is a movie moment here. Rebecca lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from her camel and said to the servant, who's that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, that's my master. So she took her veil and covered herself, which in the ancient world, this is like a sign of submission. I'm so much humility here. And it's a sign that she's pure and that nobody gets to look at her until she's married. Like, everything about this is she's honoring him. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. And then Isaac brought her into the tent of Sarah, his mother, and took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. I think that might be the first time that's used in marriage. So Isaac he's a praying man. He's a meditating man. He's a man who believes that God raises the dead. He's a man who's willing to give his life for his dad. He's a man who does all these things. He's a man that longs for his wife. And when he sees her and welcomes her, he enters into a covenant, and he loves her. This is, of the patriarchs, this is, to me, Isaac and Rebecca, they're the best. And they get the least ink, which is unfortunate. It's like all the screwballs.
Well, we need more of the other stuff. We're not
they get more ink. But Isaac and Rebecca are just, I like them a lot. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So he's been mourning the loss of Sarah, and now Rebecca's here. And the next chapter of salvation, the next chapter of the patriarchs is set to go. God has provided a bride for Isaac, this whole thing being a story of the gospel, right? And now the promise of salvation will continue for the next generation, which we'll see in a couple chapters. All right, so in some sense, when we are in this story, we play one of the two characters are our part, right? Like, we're the Eliezer that goes and presents the son. Like, we have this incredible son that is looking for a bride. And so I think we take a moment right now to say that if you have not met the Son,
yeah.
if you don't know Jesus, this is somebody who gives purpose and meaning and an inheritance. Like, he takes away your shame and your sin. He paid for it on a cross. He clothes you with righteousness. He makes death die in front of you. He gives purpose to your suffering. He loves you. He's your friend. He sees you in all of your shame and all of your high spots, low spots, and yet he sings over you with rejoicing. He gives freedom and liberty and peace. And like, he's a bridegroom far greater than anything that Eliezer is pitching. Mm-hmm. This is the God of the universe who loves humanity enough to where if people will come to him, they find salvation and an everlasting inheritance of joy. And so in one sense, like, we're Eliezer, yeah, we pitch this. But then in the other sense, we are the Rebecca figure.
Yeah, we receive.
Where we have not, like, we haven't seen him, right? Like, I can read about the Lord. And I can read about his goodness, and I can sense the Spirit, and I can do all those things. But until I see him face to face, like, there is still a huge measure of wonder to all this, right? And you got to think, like, Rebecca, when she makes this journey, has never seen him, has to question, like, what if he's abusive? What if he's got all this stuff, but he's not a good man? What if he's not going to be a good father? What if I'm walking away? What if he's incapable of having children? There's so many questions. And yet when they hear that the angel is steering all this and that the Lord is in this, they're willing to go. And here's something that Peter writes in his first epistle that it always makes me think of Rebecca when I read this, except it's a verse for us. He says, though you have not seen him, you love him.
Yeah.
And though you do not see him now, you believe in him and rejoice with joy that is inexpressible and filled with glory, obtaining the outcome of your faith, the salvation of your souls. So in that sense, we are in this sense of an arranged marriage where the Father, from the beginning of time, has written a story. He's purchased a bride. And though we haven't seen him, if we will but say, God, I trust you, and your character, and I want to be counted among the bride, you know, set apart for you, then our story will be far, far greater than anything Rebecca could have ever dreamed of, except it will be an eternal story in which we are brought into the royal family of God himself. And that's a story worth being a part of.
Amen.
Amen. So we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for watching this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next time as we get to the death of Abraham and the next generation. Isaac becomes the central figure. God bless. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.